أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وبه نستعين، إنه خير ناصر ومعين. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد، وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. My respected elders, brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. For the protection of the Imam of our time and all the pilgrims who are making their way to perform the ziyarah of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, please recite a loud salawat. There was once an individual who traveled outside of the vicinity and went into the cold regions in another land. And this was at the time of our sixth Imam alayhi salam. And what happened is that while he was traveling, it was very cold outside. And the only thing that he could find was snow and ice. There was no water. And it so happened that the situation arises where he needs to perform a ghusl. And as you know, in order to do wudu, you can't use snow. You need to have water. According to a tradition which appears in our books of hadith, one of the companions of Imam Sadiq goes to him and asks him about this man's situation. He says that he had to perform ghusl, he couldn't find anything but snow and ice. But the Imam alayhi salam clarifies the ruling for him. He says that he is in a state of compulsion and he should perform tayammum. Right, this is something that we know. If you can't do wudu, then according to the circumstances, according to the guidelines that are given, the default is to perform tayammum. Now, what's interesting is what the Imam says afterwards, and this is something that would, inshallah, will be the focus of our discussion tonight with the barakah of this beautiful tradition from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. The Imam goes on to say that I would not want him to return to that land again in which his practice of faith is going to be destroyed. The man is traveling through the land. He is performing something which is perfectly valid. His salat is going to be valid when he does the tayammum. But yet the Imam alayhi salam is saying that if this is going to be the way it's going to be, where all of his prayers are going to be have to be done with tayammum, then I don't want that for him, because that's going to destroy his faith. Now, these type of traditions we need to not just take as the surface value and say, okay, fine, so this gives us a ruling that you can do tayammum in place of wudu, now let's go on to the next tradition. Remember, the Ahlul Bayt have told us to ponder upon their words, to see the wisdom behind them. One of the very important lessons that we gain from this tradition is that when it comes to the practice of the religion, we cannot take our place and the land that we live in as an excuse to not be practicing. The Imam Alayhi Salam says very clearly that if it's going to mean that he's going to compromise on his faith, and one of the aspects of his faith is to be able to practice the laws of Islam, to cleanse oneself according to the instructions of God, if he's not going to be able to do that, then he should not go back to that land. And we take the converse of that, which means that if we are in a land, then we cannot take our situation, the place we're in, as an excuse to not be practicing. And therefore, the discussion that we're going to have tonight has to do with the practice of Islamic law. Now, in terms of titles for a lecture, I already see somebody yawning because I'm sure he's tired, he has a good excuse, but the title itself, Islamic law, usually brings about yawns. People think of Islamic law as being something dry and boring, and usually we don't want to discuss these types of things, and there's reasons behind that. I'm not going to get into that whole detail, but the point is that inshallah we're going to discuss this, and it's going to be something which is very inshallah interesting for us and very inspiring, if you'll help me with one of your loud salawats. The ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt, as we know, are an explanation and a further clarification of that light which emanates from the Quran itself. In Surah An-Nisa, verse number 97, remember at the beginning of the lecture series, those of you who are with us, I encourage you to look at the Quran and look for this particular theme about what in the Quran is there for our situation, living as a minority in a land which predominantly is not Muslim. Here's one of these ayat, which very much reflects the theme of what we're talking about. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم الذين تتوفاهم الملائكة ظالمي أنفسهم. There will be people who, when the angels will come to take their souls, they'll be in a state of doing dhulm to themselves. And we've explained what that means in the past. It means people who had turned away willingly from the guidance of Allah, and they're committing a great act of oppression to themselves. And God forbid that we should die in a state where we knowingly are disobeying God and we haven't repented for our past. قَالُوا فِيمَا كُنْتُمْ. They'll ask them, what's the deal? This is my paraphrase. What's the deal? Why is it that you're dying in this state? قَالُوا كُنَّا مُسْتَضْعَفِينَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. They'll say that we had an excuse. What's our excuse? The place that we were in, the land that we were in, something about it prevented us from fully embracing the truth and going for the deen and practicing it. The angels will reply, قَالُوا أَلَمْ تَكُنْ أَرْضُ اللَّهِ وَاسِعًا. Is it not the case that the earth of Allah was expansive and wide? فَتُهَاجِرُوا فِيهَا. That you should be able to migrate therein. فَأُولَٰئِكَ مَأَوَاهُمْ جَهَنَّمُ وَسَاءَتْ مَصِيرًا. For these people who knowingly violated the and turned away from that path of truth, they will themselves have created a destination for themselves. They've created their own hereafter, which is nothing but fire. Again, from this ayah of the Quran, the takeaway we're coming with is not that we all have to move out of here. Okay, let's go back to our home countries. Because for most of us, that doesn't even make sense. Our home country is this country. Or another country which is a non-Muslim country, non-majority Muslim country. That's not the takeaway. The takeaway is this, that when it comes to the land that we're in, the situation that we're in, it cannot be used as an excuse for not committing ourselves to the deen of Islam. I want to speak a little bit about this point, about the ability to practice Islam in the Western society. And then I want to talk a little, inshallah, about why we need to do so. So first point, that the deen of Islam, one of the defining characteristics about it is that it's very flexible. It's something which can be adaptable to whatever situation we're put in. And we're seeing this from the Imam alayhi salam as well too. He's saying that for that situation, he could do tayammum, but let not that be a something which continues, and that's going to be the main way which he approaches doing his tahara. And we see that in many situations. Allah says in the Quran, مَا جَعَلَ عَلَيْكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ مِنْ حَرَجٍ. Allah doesn't make your deen difficult to you. So the question that we should be asking ourselves at this point is that why is it that sometimes we find it very difficult to fully put the laws of Islam into practice? And just think about different situations. Right? We're living in a society where not all the food is halal. Not everything is tahir. Many work situations we go into, we find ourselves kind of stuck, not knowing what to do. There is money out there, careers out there, which give us wealth which is impure, etc., etc. The dress code that we are to adhere to is different than the dress code of the society, and so many other situations. Why is it that we find it difficult? If deen is flexible, then why is it that we're finding it sometimes difficult? And the discussion even itself we find difficult to even engage in. One of the reasons, brothers and sisters, sometimes is that a lack of understanding about the flexibility that's already coded into the laws of Islam. Let me give you an example. This happens to us sometimes. That we're in a situation where our clothing becomes najis. And it's time for prayer. All right, time is running. We get to a point where we're not in a situation where we can change our clothing, and we realize that, for example, the sun is going to set, we haven't done our Dhuhrain prayers. Now, is this a familiar situation? Does it sound familiar? Inshallah, it does. Okay, it happens. Now, in this situation, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to feel guilty of the fact that our clothes are najis and therefore we're not able to say our prayers the way we want to? Are we supposed to do something drastic, go buy a pair of clothing from the local Tesco? Do they offer clothes at Tesco? Let's say they offer clothes there. Buy a new pair of clothing and then put it on. Is that what we're called to do? Or is our deen a deen which is flexible? In every situation, it gives us a way which is reasonable, which is acceptable, which we can do without having any haraj, any extreme difficulty. This is the ruling on this issue. Just, I'm giving you an example. That if it's a situation that the only clothing we have access to is najis, and we have to say our prayers, we don't have an option, then it's not necessary to do qada. With that same piece of clothing, we can say our prayers, and our prayer will be sahih. Right? We didn't have an option. Time was running. It was a choice between making our prayer qada, not doing it, versus doing it in time with this clothing that is najis. Then go ahead. This is what Allah says. You can check the ruling yourself. This is checked according to Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Khuyi as well too, that you can go ahead and do that prayer in that only piece of clothing that you have, which is najis. You don't have access to other clothing, and your prayer will be sahih. There are many issues like this, brothers and sisters, where sometimes our lack of deep understanding of how to apply the laws, sometimes we create difficulties for ourselves. Sometimes that lack of understanding is coupled with something else which tends to be quite dangerous, which is what? Which is a tendency to think that the cultural background we come from is part of the Islamic law. And I'll give you some examples. So let me give you a simple example first of all. One time, I was explaining the rules of ghusl of janabah. And afterwards, this young brother came up to me. Actually, he wasn't that young. He was already 19 or 20 years old. And this is important, and you'll see why. So he comes up to me, he's a little bit shy, you know, a little bit hesitant, and kind of, he's waiting for everyone else to kind of go away. He says, "I have a question for you, Brother Salim." I said, "Okay, what is the question?" He says that my father taught me that when I do the ghusl janabah, I have to turn that handle of the water all the way to cold. And that's when I can start doing my ghusl. And sometimes I find it difficult to do that. So what should I do in that situation? It gets cold, he says, in the winter time here. And the cold water, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm going to get sick about it. So I told him, I said that actually there's no such thing in the deen. So don't quote me on this. Yeah, there's no ruling like that. There's nothing like that. Where the water has to be cold in order for your ghusl to be sahih, that's something that your respected father must have picked up from as a sort of a folklore, as a tradition in the culture. It has nothing to do with the deen of Islam. Please go perform your ghusls and do so using whatever temperature water that you fancy. That's what the ruling is. Now you might be rolling your eyes and thinking that, okay, Brother Salim, that's just ridiculous, right? We learned that, you know, back then. But there are more examples to that that perhaps apply to our situation as well. I remember back when I was a child that sometimes when you hang out with people who want to be very religious and they haven't understood properly, it gives us a wrong impression of the deen, particularly this situation, where somebody was showing me, I remember very clearly when I was a child, that after you finish washing your hands in the tap in a public restroom, or what do you call it, washroom, bathroom, you know what I'm talking about, that WC, that facility, you wash your hands, now you're exiting, he showed me a very complicated, but at that point I was impressed, technique of taking a paper towel and using it to like open up the handle of the door and then tossing it into the garbage can and doing that whole thing without ever contaminating your wet hand with the handle of the door, because there might be a possibility that the handle was touched by somebody whose hand was najis and it got wet, and then your hand is going to be najis again. So is this familiar with you? And by the way, it's okay to crack a smile. It's, you know, it's fine. It's perfect. Nobody's going to take a picture of you, put it on Facebook and say anything about it. It's okay. Okay. So inshallah, this is some situation. Maybe it's familiar. Like, but wait a minute. Wait. When you go back to this, let's try to understand. First of all, kullu shay'in laka tahirun hatta ta'lama annahu qadiran. This is a law, a principle of law, that everything for you is tahir until you know with certainty that it is najis. Now, do I know for certainty that there's some najasan on that handle? No, right? So go ahead. If you want, out of hygienic considerations, you want to do something, then that's your own prerogative, but it's not part of the deen. Again, you might say that, okay, no, we got that figured out, but let's take it to other examples. And some of these, my apologies, if they might be a little bit sort of inciting a little bit of discussion. That's my goal isn't to be controversial. It's to raise discussion and awareness. Example, what is the position of Islam with regards to the relationship between parents and the daughter-in-law, or parents and the son-in-law? Is it the case that when a daughter-in-law comes into the family, then she is now a daughter? Okay, on one perspective, of course, in the sense that we love her the way we love our own daughter. We treat her with care and we want to provide for her, etc. And, you know, she's part of our family right now. However, we have to be careful not to mix culture with deen. Is it permissible for a parent to have expectations on their son, for example? And is it obligatory for the son to respect his parents' wishes, to not do anything to trouble them on account of him? Yes, and there's some parameters and discussion there about exactly what the ruling is, but to a certain extent, a son does need to have a sense of appreciation of what his parents want and has to be careful not to do things which cause them trouble and troubles them. But does the same rule apply to the daughter-in-law? This is something which needs to be discussed. And sometimes if we go and look into this, we realize that Islam provides us with a very, very beautiful understanding of the interplay. That even though we are one family from one perspective, we're not one family from another perspective. We're still two families. There's two circles. There's the original family, and then there's this new family that's developing as well too. And it's very important that we give that new family room to develop without interfering. Being there as a source of consultation, support, but not as a source of dictation. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now there's other examples as well. I don't have time to explain, but just let me raise the issue. Music. Okay, you remember the times when music comes on TV? Haram, haram, turn it off, haram. Okay, switch it off. Now, I'm not saying that when music comes on the TV, we need to jack up the volume or that we need to listen to whatever comes out. In fact, I'm not even saying that we should even watch TV. Okay, and that's not my concern. I'm not discussing that issue right now. But when it comes to distinguishing between what is halal and haram, we should be clear on the law and not give an impression that that which is halal is haram. Maybe there might be something that we as a family, we as a sub-unit in our group of close believers, we're going to take a certain stand as to what how we operate with media and music and these issues. But let's be clear on what is the halal and what is the haram. And we need to discuss that. Is music haram? No. There's halal music and there's haram music and there's guidelines and they're specific and we can understand these, but they need to be understood. And finally, okay, let me just add in one more thing to you, even more controversial tonight. Okay, and don't throw those rotten tomatoes, it's okay. Gender relationships. Gender relationships is something that we need to understand. What is the wajib and what is the haram? What is the ihtiyat, which is good to observe? And where is it the case that if we observe that ihtiyat and we go overboard, it's going to cause the religion itself to be seen as weak in the eyes of the people, and therefore we need to disregard that extra ihtiyat. This is a discussion that needs to be had. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. See, brothers and sisters, we have to realize that we're living in a society where there's a lot of emphasis put on the individual. Whatever I think is important in this particular attitude, when we mix that with the idea of there being a law from God explained by the Ahlul Bayt, conveyed to us by the pure and pious scholars of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, sometimes when they come together, there's a bit of conflict, and we have to be aware of this. And we see this happening. Let me give you an example. Somebody asked the question that what's the big deal if this piece of hair is showing? Right? One of the laws that we have in Islam, and this is something where there's no debate about this, it's not like a controversial thing, is that a woman in the presence of a non-mahram man has to cover up. And no hair can be displayed, only the face and the hands. Okay, this is the gist of it, and of course there's details. What's the big deal? All right, show a bit of hair, who cares? Show hair, don't care, right? What's the big deal after all? Okay, what I myself, this is the type of thinking, and if you ask them what they're saying, they say that I myself am very much aware of my spiritual state. If I'm showing a strand of hair or two or five or six, all right, then I'm not going to lose out in any way on my spirituality. After all, most of it's being covered. And who out there even cares? If the purpose is to prevent people from being attracted to my hair, then how can they be possibly attracted to five strands of hair after all? Right? Etc., etc. And you can continue the discussion. Right. Now, you can apply this to a lot of situations. What's the big deal if I shake her hand? What's the big deal if we go out on this particular social gathering and I sit at that table in which alcohol is being served? I'm not drinking the alcohol. He's drinking the alcohol. And I asked him to put a special cover on it so that I'm not going to even smell the fumes that are wafting from it. So what's the big deal after all? I don't see anything. No, in all these situations, brothers and sisters, we have to ask ourselves that is the problem with the law, or is there a more fundamental problem with ourselves? Are we not putting ourselves in a situation which is not for us to be in? When we say these types of things, suddenly the determiner of what is right and wrong, what is haq and batil, becomes none other than yours truly. I become the one who defines truth and falsehood in this universe. Am I not taking on a position and sitting on a seat which is not meant for me to sit on? That's number one. Number two is what? Number two is that I'm assuming that I understand this universe. And I can see the sum total of everything that takes place, and I can determine whether something is harmful or it's not harmful for me. But guess what, brothers and sisters? Our knowledge of this physical universe is very, very limited. We're still in the infant stages of trying to understand and comprehend the relationship between different things. You're saying that sitting on that table, which has alcohol on it, as long as you're not drinking, it has no effect. Well, how much do we understand about this universe? Let me give you a couple of examples. They did an experiment, it's a famous experiment, you must have heard about it, where they would say positive things and put positive signs next to water that was to be frozen. And they would say good things to it. And another jug of water, they would say negative things. They would curse it out and put negative signs and imagery around it. And the theory that they posited, and they tried to prove it by demonstrating, was that that water, which was talked to in a good way, when it froze into a beautiful formation, while that water that was abused formed into something which was not beautiful. They took that same experiment and they applied it to apples. They cut an apple in half. One half they put in a container in which the word bad was written, and another one they put in which the word good was written. And then throughout the week they would talk very lovingly to the good half piece of apple, and they would curse out the bad half of the apple. And guess what? Afterwards, they saw that the apple, the one that was, you know, talked to nicely, was just a little bit, it was about a week's time, I believe, it was intact mostly. The other one was falling apart. It was totally like black. Now you might say that, no, this is quack science. It's not something that we can substantiate, right? It doesn't hold up to any scientific theories. Let me give you another example. They say that, and this is something that is even more established, right? And this is something many of you can even sympathize, maybe you experienced it, that when a woman becomes pregnant with her child, the mother becomes pregnant with her child, the father himself undergoes some physical changes. And sometimes those physical changes, the introduction of estrogen into his body, the hormonal changes, is so much so that he experiences a mild form of morning sickness, just as his wife is experiencing morning sickness. And he has these feelings of tenderness and love that appear as if from nowhere. Now we have to ask the question that, wait a minute, what's the difference between this time and all those other times when there was no conception that took place? Why is it that this time, this particular reaction happened? And they don't know the answer. Even if you go and you can disprove the other's experience, but the point is that, brothers and sisters, we don't know that much about this universe. When we say and we make statements about things, then who's to say that we understand things? And all of that is just limited to the physical realm. What about the spiritual realm? Those five strands of hair, what do I understand? What sort of spiritual impact that's going to have on my soul? Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now the discussion until now, brothers and sisters, has been about trying to show how we can follow the law, and also how some of the misconceptions we have towards it prevent us from embracing and following it. I understand that there are situations, some of them I mentioned, where it becomes difficult, but that's part of our challenge of living here in this society. I want to take it one step further. Okay, I want to raise the volume a little bit here. All right. I want to say the following, that not only can we follow these laws, we need to follow them as well too. It's necessary. What I mean by that is that these laws that we have in Islam, they are given to us with a very important purpose. The one time, one of the companions writes to Imam Ridha alayhi salam. He asks him, he says that some people are saying that these laws that we have, there's no purpose behind them, they're just meant to test people. Just a matter of seeing who's going to submit and who's not going to submit. And the Imam writes back, he says that whoever has said such a thing has gone very far from the truth. But rather, we see the servants of God not being in need of those things which are prohibited and those things which are haram, and those things that are haram are corruptive and invite them towards destruction and annihilation. Those things which we're told are prohibited actually destroy us, they annihilate us, in the words of Imam Radha alayhi salam. Whereas those things which we're told to do, which are wajib for us to do, which we're encouraged to do, actually have a positive effect on our lives as well too. I want to explore this topic a bit here, which is this idea that we need the religion of Islam. We need to practice this law. We need to put it into our lives and embrace it fully. And I want to do so with a couple of examples from the lives of our ulama. There was once a time when Allama Tabatabai rahmatullahi alayhi was walking in the streets of Qum, and he was going along his way. He was observing the rights and the laws of a pedestrian. Somebody came on a bicycle and didn't observe the proper rights, didn't yield to the pedestrian, and he basically ran smack into him. Okay, now, in this situation, who is at fault here? Is it the pedestrian or is it the bicycle rider? Obviously, it's the bicycle rider. And he's a young man. He doesn't realize whom he just ran into. He sees that he's in just an old-looking, you know, ahund, as they say in the language, the Farsi language. Allama Tabatabai never used to walk around with splendid robes or make a show of himself. Very simple, very humble. So he gets up and, you know, he's brushing himself off, the young man, and he says that next time you should make sure that you walk straight, old man. And rudely he walks away. Okay, now Allama Tabatabai, like somebody is there, he's watching this incident, and he said, look at his reaction. What does he say? He says that may Allah guide us all to be straight on his path. Okay, this is a small example of the akhlaq of an individual who has built himself by means of the religion of Islam and by following the laws of Islam. Islam and the laws mold us into what a human being ought to be. Why? This is the key point. Because somebody who embraces the laws of Islam, life doesn't become about just me and you. It becomes about God, and that makes all the difference. Ayatollah Taliqani, who is one of the shuhada, one day he realizes that he got angry, and it wasn't because of a justified cause. He addresses himself immediately and he says the following. He says that, Sag Shadi, have you become a dog that you're acting in this way? Why? Because he's worked himself, he checks himself, he realizes that it's not about me and my own ego. There's a presence of God which checks us and puts us into balance. Where do they get this from? They get this from the example of the Imams on Islam. How did the Imams become how they were? Could Imam Hussein have accomplished what he did had he not been at the highest point of subservience to the law of Islam? They say that when Imam Hussein would wake up in the morning, once somebody asked him, he said that, how is it that you find yourself right now? And he goes on to say something very beautiful. He says that, I woke up this morning and I found that I was present and that there is a Lord who is above me. And I am completely dependent on him. I'm paraphrasing. And then he goes on to say, فَأَيُّ فَقِيرٍ أَفْقَرُ مِنِّي. Is there anybody who is needy, who is more needy than I am? You see how somebody who practices the deen of Islam, it takes them to a point where they eminently feel that connection between them and God. Imagine if somebody takes this spirit and they take it into their relationships. The relationship of a husband with his wife, that when something comes up, an argument comes up, I eminently feel the presence of Allah and I act according to that criteria. Not according to how my own passions and my own ego and how badly I feel about this or how hurt I am. No. Because I have trust in God, and Allah tells me, what does He tell me? He says that if they too, in yurida islahan, yuwaffiqhum Allah biha. Or to that extent, that if they desire, if there's two, a husband and wife, who are quarreling and there's concern about divorce, but if they want it to be repaired, then Allah is promising in the Quran that He's going to fix that relationship for them. But they have to want to take those steps to want to repair that relationship. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, I realize that time is running. We don't have that much time to pursue. I want to draw towards the close here. The point that we gain from that tradition at the beginning is that the Imam alayhi salam, and then similarly in that verse of the Quran, that we should not use our situation as an excuse to run away from Islamic law. We're creating and setting ourselves up for disaster if we were to do so, but rather we have to understand well how this religion provides flexibility and how we can put that into practice. We need to see the Islamic law as an opportunity. When I find out about a new law, it's not that I groan and moan, but rather I see this as a means of getting closer to Allah by observing this law. For example, sometimes our ladies go to Umrah or they go to Hajj, and it just so happens that they are not able to enter into Masjid al-Haram and perform the tawaf at the time that they are there because of certain circumstances. Now in that situation, if the law tells me that I cannot go and perform that, but I have to follow these procedures right here, does that mean that in some way I'm missing out on that thawab and that experience? Not at all. In every situation, as long as we're doing what our responsibility is, then it's going to be a means of getting closer to Allah. Number one was that we need to see this as an opportunity. Number two is that we need to give more credit to our maraji. That they are the ones who have spent 30, 40, 50, 60 years painstakingly to bring to us this very law, which is a means of transporting ourselves to God and a means of being the best human beings a human being can possibly be. So don't we owe a little bit more credit to them? Sometimes we wonder, why is it that they're so busy doing what they're doing, but we don't understand. There was once an alim, this story really, when I heard it, it was something that really stuck with me, and I want to share it with you tonight. It's okay, inshallah, it's a Friday night, I know that you don't have work tomorrow. You can, inshallah, relax a little bit and enjoy, inshallah. There was an alim who, this was at the time when he was in Najaf, he was a marja, the marja alam. One of his muqallideen comes to his door and submits to him a list of questions and says that, Agha, I want answers to these questions. He comes back, he says, okay, fine, I'll get you the answer. He comes back the next day, knocks on the door, answer's not ready, come back tomorrow. Knocks on the door, answer's not ready, come back tomorrow, so on and so forth. He does this for 6 months. At the end of 6 months, he's like, that's it. I can't take this anymore. He goes and finds an average, you know, mujtahid, and he says that, okay, here's my questions, please answer them for me. And the very next day, that average mujtahid comes and gives him the answers, and he's like, okay, I got my answers. Now, before he goes about his business, right, he pays a visit back to that a'lam mujtahid. Right, and he says that, you know, agha, I gave you those questions, and it's been 6 months, and you didn't answer me. But I took them to that other agha, and he answered me in 1 day. What's up? What's going on? So he says, let me see that paper. Let me see the answer that he gave. And he takes it, and he says, hold on a second. He goes back into his papers. He rummages through, and he pulls out that letter that he had originally written with the question. He says that, actually, I answered your questions the very day that you gave me. Them to me. However, and then he compared, and he said, actually, our answers are very similar as well too. But, you know the reason why I didn't give you the answers? Because from that time until now, I was in a state of doubt, and I wanted to be sure that the answer that I'm giving you is the law of God. Because God forbid that I should tell you to do something that is contrary to what God wants you to do. Islamic law is not something easy that we can just sit here and make comments about and say that this city and Qum and Najaf and these type of cities, they waste their time there. It's a very complicated science, and it's made even more complicated by the knowledge that there's responsibility in giving fatwas. Because if the mujtahid were to make a mistake and he did so by applying his very best ijtihad and came up with the answer that he thought was right, then he's going to be forgiven. But if he didn't do a good job, if he was lax in some area, if he did guesswork and wasn't sure about the answer he's given, then he's going to be responsible for the acts of all those who followed him as well too. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The final takeaway, okay, I mentioned two takeaways. Number one was that of seeing laws as an opportunity. Number two was respecting Amaraj. The final, and then we're going to move into Masab, inshallah, is that at the very least, brothers and sisters, let's not mock the law of Islam. What I mean by that is that sometimes the snide comments that we make on forums, Facebook, public, social media, about Islamic law, or forget about comments, even the way that we go about presenting ourselves becomes a mockery of the Islamic law. Here I am promoting the cause of Imam Hussein through my, for example, Facebook profile status. And at the same time, I'm putting up pictures where I'm sitting with my co-workers and we all have our arms around each other and she's a girl and I'm a guy. Here I am talking about that particular experience and that trip that I went on where such and such thing happened and I made my salat qada. And people are pressing like, hey, that's a good story right there. Right, these things are very serious, brothers and sisters. Gender interaction is taken very seriously by God and by the Imams. Let me end with the story. One time, this one companion of Imam Sadiq engages in an act which was inappropriate in terms of gender interaction. The next day, the Imam alayhi salam comes to him without even any sort of introduction or asking or query. He addresses him. He says, "Tub ila Allahi mimma sana'at al-bariha." Oh, so and so, repent to God over what you did yesterday. I myself, and I tell myself this, inshallah, all of you, that God forbid that I should be the subject of rebuke of the Imam of my time. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Tonight, brothers and sisters, we wish to look a little bit at the story of our beloved fourth Imam, alayhi salam. They say that one time there was a man who had visited the Kaaba and he had spent the night there. And as he was worshipping Allah, he heard somebody crying out in the middle of the night. And as he went to see who is it that this person is, he saw that there was a man who was clinging to the cloth surrounding the Kaaba. What is he saying? He's saying, "Ala ayyuhal ma'amulu fi kulli hajatin." Oh, the one who is hoped for in any need that we have. "Shakawtu ilayka durra fasma' shikayati." I'm complaining to you about my situation. So hear me out and hear my complaint. What do I have to say? "Ala ya raja'i anta kashifu kurbati." You are my hope. You are the one who can take care of my affliction. "Fahabli dhunubi kullaha waqdi hajati." Forgive me all of my sins and grant me my request to you. "Zadi qalilun ma arahu muballighi." When I look at whatever I've done, I see it insufficient in taking me to where I want to go. What is the question that this man who is crying out in the middle of the night, what is the question that he has for Allah? "Alizzadi abki, alizzadi abki amli bu'adi masafati." Should I cry over the little amount of what I've stored up for myself in terms of my actions? Or should I cry because of the far distance I have and the distance I have between you and between me and you, O my beloved? Who is this man? This is Imam Zainul Abidin. This is Sayyidul Sajidin. This is one aspect of his crying that we see. But we see another aspect as well. They say that for 20 years, according to some reports, for 40 years, whenever they would bring food or water to the Imam alayhi salam, that he would begin to cry and he began to weep until he became known as one of the bukkain, one of those who would always be weeping. One of his servants comes to him one day and says that, "Why do you do this to yourself? We fear that you're going to die because of your grief." He says that Ya'qub, Nabi Ya'qub, had 12 sons. One of them went away and he was just missing. He wasn't killed. And yet he became blind over grief of separation between him and the son. But as for me, I witness my brothers and my father and my uncles and my own family in front of me and how they killed them mercilessly. So why and how can you blame me for crying as I do? Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdillah وعلى الأرواح التي حلت بفنائك. Our salutations upon that noble Imam who with his family and companions stood strong in Karbala until they were martyred. Which of the scenes for Imam Zain al-Abidin was particularly painful? We have to ask him, O Imam, were you aware when your father, Imam Hussein, was taking your brother, that little boy of only 6 months, to the enemy? Did you know why he took him to the enemy? All he wanted was to get some water for him, but instead they gave him an arrow. Did you hear, O Imam, how there was a cry from the sky saying to Imam Hussein, O Hussein, leave him, don't worry, there is somebody to take care of him in the heaven. Did you hear your father cry out, the only way that I can bear this tragedy is knowing that it takes place in front of Allah? Allah.